The State of Commerce Experience podcast is brought to you by Bloomreach, the leader in digital commerce experience. Bloomreach provides solutions for leading businesses all across the world to both drive increased revenue and also to help them personalize the shopping experience for their customers across all of their digital channels. If you'd like to find out more, please visit bloomreach.com.
Welcome, everyone, to the State of Commerce Experience. I'm Brian Walker, and it's great to have you here. Today, I'm joined by Kiri Masters. Kiri is a founder of Bobsled Marketing, a digital agency that helps brands grow their sales in the Amazon Marketplace, specializing in operations, marketing, and advertising on the Amazon Marketplace platform. Kiri has written two books on the topic, including Amazon for CMOs, published last year. Kiri is also a regular contributor to Forbes and has her own podcast called E-Commerce Brain Trust. Kiri is a native of Australia, but founded Bobsled while based in New York City. It was great to catch up with Kiri. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Kiri, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
Kiri, here on the podcast, we like to start with sort of a standard question. And that first question is, what was your first job or assignment that dealt with e-commerce?
So actually, it was a self-made start. I started an e-commerce business back in 2013, and it was a make-your-own lamp business.
Wow.
So there's some advice that entrepreneurs get, which is niche down and get very, very specific. I can't think of anything more specific than that. So I started this, it was a craft supplies company essentially, and started that back in 2013. And that's where I first learned the ins and outs of e-commerce. I built a WordPress store. I sold on Etsy, and I eventually started selling those products on Amazon as well. And that's how I got my entry point into the world of Amazon specifically.
And then at some point you sort of decided, well, I'm actually going to go more into being an agency, helping others do the same.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So I was working in banking at the time for JP Morgan Chase in New York, and decided that, hey, I could probably go and replace my income here by consulting for manufacturers who are still figuring this Amazon thing out. And that's what I did in 2015, hung out my shingle as a consultant and started growing an agency around that. So fast forward 5 years, we've got 25 folks on the team supporting more mid-market to enterprise-sized brands with their Amazon operations, marketing, and advertising.
Well, speaking of Amazon, I'm not sure that everyone really understands fully how the Amazon Marketplace, and in particular, how the advertising kind of product works in conjunction with that. I'd love if you could share a little bit more about how that works so that people can kind of understand the advertising product in particular at Amazon, how businesses are engaging with that. And how does it work?
Yeah, so I think operation, just to set the foundation, there's two ways that products get sold on Amazon. One is where Amazon is the retailer. In a classic retail model, they place purchase orders with brands, and then they hold that inventory and they ship and sell that inventory. And that's what we call first party of the vendor channel with Amazon. And then about 50% of sales volume goes through that system. And then around half of the sales volume goes through a marketplace system where it's third-party sellers, often using Amazon's logistics infrastructure and allowing those products to be prime eligible. But it's a huge network of millions of third-party sellers in the system. So when it comes to advertising, there's also two different main sort of buckets of advertising products. One is paid search or pay-per-click advertising. And there's a lot of different types of campaigns that we can set up these days, but this is really click-based paid search. And Amazon's a very, very competitive marketplace these days. There's lots of products. There's lots of brands vying for our attention. And for many brands, the only guaranteed way to get on top of page one for a given search query is to pay for it. So the paid search advertising ecosystem is a very, very important strategy for a lot of brands. And as an agency at Bobsled, we see typically like a good rule of thumb, and every brand and category is going to be a little bit different, but we generally want to see about 25% of sales coming through ad the paid channel. So it's getting more and more competitive to advertise there. I think in general, Amazon's ad ecosystem has simply been around for less time than a Facebook or a Google. They're taking a lot of cues from that playbook. But up until a couple of years ago, we would have called the Amazon advertising ecosystem relatively new and immature in terms of features. There was no negative keywords. There was no retargeting option. We're starting to see all those features start to come through. So it's becoming more mature and more complex. And that has been very helpful to brands because they're able to dial things in a little bit more. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we've got Amazon's DSP, their programmatic media buying system, where you can advertise on everything from a Kindle wake screen to Amazon Prime Video to lots of third-party sites around the internet, and get very interesting targeting there. Like, I could bid on a shopper who has viewed my competitors' products and not purchased them, and I can actually target them with a display ad. So that is an impression, you know, more classic media buy that's impression-based.
Very interesting. So is the ad product, for example, paid search and kind of within the marketplace, is that a typical CPM type model that they're using, which means cost per million?
Cost per click.
Yeah, cost per click. So what would, let's say, a relatively popular competitive search term, you know, what would that roughly cost in the Amazon environment?
Yeah, that's a how long is a piece of string question. Up until COVID-19, the most popular search term on Amazon was Bluetooth headphones. So if you're a Bluetooth headphones manufacturer, you would be paying probably a couple to a few dollars per click for that term. Super competitive. Tons of people want to bid on that one. And it's an auction format as well, like pretty much all of the paid search players. So that search term is going to be very, very competitive. If I was bidding for make your own lampshade, you know, that's not going to be a very competitive term. So,
well, it is interesting because obviously to participate in the marketplace, you are sharing in the margin, right? There's a percentage depending on the category that you're selling in that you're going to share with Amazon. And that's, you know, going to range typically, I think, between, say, low teens and high teens in terms of a share. And then, of course, if you're bidding for these keywords, which is, of course, going to be very important to be discovered, especially as more and more shoppers shop on a mobile device, becomes even more critical. You're also, you know, paying for that as well on top of your share so the margin impact in total can be, you know, a pretty significant amount. And of course, Amazon is now, as you said, it's I don't know exactly the percentage now, but it is roughly 50% of their total retail sales through their platform is coming via marketplace, which is pretty interesting. Yeah, I worked at Amazon in the mid-2000s, really, as the marketplace was just getting started. And I think what's kind of interesting is that people don't realize that Amazon first tried to kind of mimic eBay with something called Z Shops, and that didn't work particularly well. And the big innovation really here is when Bezos and Amazon decided to go to a model where everyone shared the same product detail page, essentially, for the same product, and started enabling people to not only put their product in the marketplace, but also, if you were selling something that, you know, was somewhat commodity or the same, right, brand or SKU, you were on the same page, right? And you're bidding for the buy box at the time. And of course, that leads to another interesting phenomenon I want to talk to you about, which is something that the New York Times wrote about back in February, which now seems like eons ago, of course, given everything that's happened. But it was a very interesting kind of expose of sorts that they wrote. The title is relatively long, but I'm going to go ahead and read it. All your favorite brands from BSTOEM to ZGGCD, how Amazon is causing us to drown in trademarks. Again, pretty long title, but I guess the New York Times can get away with that. You know, this article was sort of showcasing the way in which primarily Chinese brands and manufacturers are creating what they were calling pseudo brands to reach and sell to consumers via marketplaces, with Amazon as the principal one. And of course, these pseudo brands mimic the look and feel of well-known brands. You know, products like yoga pants, for example, or gloves. And these are sort of made-up brands that seem quite sort of plausible when you see them, but they really only exist for manufacturers to sell directly into these marketplaces. I guess I'm curious, to what degree do you see this as an opportunity or a threat to traditional CPG brands?
Yeah, this is a really big topic. And I think that the first thing to think about is that this is not the first time where we've had sort of no-name brands coming in and competing with national brands. You go to the dollar store and you're going to find these
private label. Yeah.
There's private label, and then there's also sort of these no-name brands that have seen a hot trend. The Bluetooth headphones have come in and developed an alternative product there. The difference is with Amazon, it's very, very overwhelming. If you go and search for especially a consumer technology product on Amazon, like Bluetooth headphones, cell phone case, Bluetooth laptop, keyboard, whatever, you can barely recognize a brand on page one or page two of search results. So it does feel very overwhelming in its scale. The reason why these companies who would otherwise have probably just in an eBay situation, not really gone to much effort to create a brand and trademark it, certainly that's a huge administrative cost and burden. The reason is once you have a trademark, you can apply for a program Amazon calls Brand Registry, and that unlocks a lot of enhanced content and advertising and analytics capabilities. So that's why the USPTO is being overrun with these no-name brand registrations. So yeah, in some categories, it's extremely overwhelming. And those are categories of commodity products largely. A lot of people are happy with a cheap keyboard or mouse or Bluetooth headset. Baby formula, probably not. So it is very category dependent. So it's going to be a threat for brands in those categories. They're going to have to work a little bit harder to talk about the trust that they have and, you know, why their product is not going to be faulty in 3 weeks as opposed to the cheaper alternative. But yeah, it is very pervasive. It's classic copycat, cheaper alternative, market driven.
I guess I'm kind of curious, given the COVID crisis, right, that has, of course, impacted supply chains pretty significantly, but also changed perhaps consumer behavior. You know, do you have any point of view on how these marketplaces that are really being, you know, driven in many cases by these manufacturers, you know, and their pseudo brands, do you have any sense for how the COVID situation might impact this trend?
I think there'll be a bifurcation, and it's going to be, again, category driven. In some categories that require high trust, like food, baby products, things like that, I think there's going to be a flight back to heritage brands with a lot of trust, because people want a bit more security in their lives. They want to know what they're buying and that they're going to be able to rely on that brand. They want something that they can recognize. In other categories, the volume of alternative sellers and cheaper options, frankly, is going to be a huge draw for Amazon, because China's supply chain is coming back online and the manufacturers and export industry there is able to fulfill orders for products that are difficult to get in the US right now. So it's going to be a very divided trend.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm also interested in your perspective on how the COVID crisis, and in particular Amazon's, and you know, necessary response in some ways to prioritize essential items at the expense of third-party marketplace sellers, you know, including not accepting new shipments, not allowing inventory to even be pulled out of the warehouse because that would be labor intensive. This kind of put the handcuffs on a lot of these third-party sellers, some of which might be based in the United States and sourcing products from overseas, some of which may be direct from manufacturers overseas as well, as we've been discussing. I'm just kind of curious, how do you think the ecosystem is going to respond to that? What might be the lingering impacts of this sort of prioritization and decision? And does it change the sort of equation that businesses, in many cases small businesses, in some cases these are manufacturers again going direct. How do you think this temporary, hopefully, situation leads to longer term impacts?
I think that directionally Amazon did the right thing. Given the constraints of labor and capacity that they have, this was the right call to make. Unfortunately, because they had to change things so quickly, categorization of certain products as essential or non-essential was not perfect. And so a lot of brands that we have spoken with or worked with saw very strange categorization on their catalog of some products being essential, some not, their top sellers not being essential, but the other variations of a, you know, a beverage product. Some flavors were essential, some flavors weren't. It was just not super
consistent. Well, I like grapefruit, so I hope, you know, that was important.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, you know, it's impossible to execute something like this perfectly, but in general, it was the right thing to do. The impact to many brands was very unfortunate in that some of their top sellers were not classified as essential. That meant that they couldn't ship it in. That meant that Amazon would run out of inventory. They'd have to start fulfilling their own orders. Something very interesting happened in Amazon's sort of algorithmic logic, though, which was you get preference on this buy box that you mentioned, which is Amazon's algorithm of figuring which merchant gets the sale for a product that multiple merchants have inventory of. Previously, the variable that would determine who gets the sale is who has prime eligible inventory, which you get from Amazon being the processor, the fulfiller. Yeah. In these times where Amazon was they were putting ship dates out of 30 days, we saw for the first time ever them shift their logic to whoever can ship this fastest. So it was very interesting to see them change that part of their algorithm, because they've had always a very, very, very strong weight towards that prime eligibility. And just reading, you know, shopper responses on Twitter and things like that, people are complaining, hey, I pay for this prime membership, I'm not getting things in 2 days. To some degree, like, that's not realistic. Come on, we're in the middle of a pandemic. You need to lower your expectations a little bit. But I think Amazon also realized this prime eligibility is, we need to drop that for a minute.
Well, it also took some load off of their fulfillment centers by doing
exactly
that, right? Because yes. It's like, well, look, there's all these non-essential items that we would still like to fulfill, and it's all a matter of perspective, right? What's essential to someone is not essential to someone else. How do we determine that? Maybe it's a, you know, my juicer, you know, broke, right? I was probably getting a little maniacal with the beets and carrots. And anyway, I cracked the housing that holds the actual juicing mechanism. And fortunately, you can replace it. It's a nice juicer. So getting a replacement part was not too difficult to find. But again, that's not considered essential. That's probably appropriate. But to me, you know, I really wanted to be able to make fresh juice, again, kind of focus on health and everything, right? And so it's a matter of perspective. What's essential to one consumer, you know, is not to another. But it took load off of Amazon's fulfillment centers to defer some of that fulfillment, you know, back out essentially to others, when obviously in normal times they would prefer to be processing inventory that's in their own warehouses, not only because of speed and efficiency and to reward the Prime member for that program, but also they make money for fulfilling those items as well. So there's a, but you know, given the situation, I think that was a relatively smart, quick decision. It was also interesting to see that the promise dates that they were putting out there, which were pretty extraordinarily long, they were actually exceeding, which is a longstanding Amazon trick to exceed the promise date of the consumer. So items that you thought might not show up for a month were showing up in a week. And you're like, oh, I thought this wasn't going to be coming until, you know, and I even canceled something that still showed up because the promise date had been put out there so far. And it actually shipped before I was able to cancel it. So it was kind of interesting how they were trying to kind of game that a little bit to make sure that the consumer's expectations were set far enough out that they could still exceed it. And given the situation, they probably weren't sure, right, on exactly what they were going to be able to do. I'm kind of curious, you know, given all of this that we're discussing, there are a lot of businesses that have kind of built themselves on the back of the Amazon marketplace. Or maybe they have a physical store somewhere. Maybe they're a small business somewhere and they started selling through Amazon as a way to reach consumers online and grow their business. I'm kind of curious, you know, do you perceive it as a risk for businesses to essentially do that, build their business on the back of Amazon? What is the right mix for someone in business to be thinking about relative to this channel?
Yeah, I think that the answer for anyone who has a purely Amazon-centric business is that that's a big risk. And I would advise to diversify as much as possible away from it being a single channel business. But it depends who we're talking about. If we're talking about a retailer versus a brand. So for a brand, I think they should have an Amazon business. They should be looking at their own e-com site as well as stores. They all play a different role in the customer journey of today, which is I learn about something through social media. I check it out in the store and then I might buy it in the store, but then I repurchase it online. That's a very common purchase journey that we're seeing for consumable products. For a retailer, it looks a little bit different because brands increasingly want to go direct to consumers to both build a direct relationship with them, get better feedback, as well as scoop up any additional margin that they can. Fair enough. So if you've got a pure retail business where you're reselling other brands, I think you might as well try and do that on Amazon, but also understand the brands are going to increasingly want to go direct and they're going to be upset about you being that intermediary. So I think that retailers need to do two things. One is develop their own private label brand and use that intel that they have in their market about what customers want, what they're buying, their understanding of the ecosystem. Leverage that and start building their own brand that is defensible. And then the other piece I think a retailer needs to do is look at building their own marketplace, which is, we'll talk before the show about a solution provider in this area, Mirakl, where they have helped, I think they've got 250 customers who are retailers that have built their own marketplaces. And at a time like this, for some of those retailers, their online marketplace is the only thing propping them up right now because it's the only channel that can be open for business.
Right. It's an opportunity for them to, you know, reach inventory that they don't necessarily have and extend that inventory. Most retailers saw this as sort of a line extension mechanism, right, into categories they weren't kind of investing in themselves. I think for a lot of retailers in particular, it's been kind of challenging to fully embrace the marketplace strategy, partly because it's just kind of gone against their DNA a little bit. But it is interesting to see the growth of this. And I do think this situation that we're in now may actually accelerate the marketplace trend as businesses look to diversify their inventory, potentially even bring essential, quote unquote, products into that marketplace in the short term, even if they're not typically in those categories. It'll be very interesting to see how that plays out, which kind of leads to another question, like, you know, what alternative marketplaces are out there for brands and or retailers who are looking to sell through it? Obviously, in North America, Amazon is currently the dominant marketplace. But there are certainly others out there, as we've said, trying to add these in, maybe even enable commerce inside what is otherwise a social, you know, kind of sharing environment like Pinterest, for example. There's obviously
Instagram.
Etsy. Yeah. There's Instagram, of course, is very interesting for kind of a single product and digital native brands, right, to get a start and reach consumers. eBay, of course, is kind of still out there, still a fairly decent sized player, but with a still a different model and some challenges, right, unifying their assortment into what essentially is a marketplace versus an auction kind of driven environment. There's Walmart as well. I guess I'm just kind of curious your view as you look at the landscape, you know, what other marketplaces would you advise a client to explore and how do you see that evolving?
Yeah, it's a great question because as an agency, we've always focused on Amazon because it's just where the money is. It's where the shoppers are. It's where the development is. And over the years, we've looked at, should we look at this marketplace or that one? And we've always ultimately decided, you know, we're just going to focus on Amazon because there is still so much work to do. And the brands who continue to reach out to us, I look at them like, what, really? They weren't on Amazon? They were not investing in this channel? There's still a lot of brands who are still figuring out their Amazon strategy. Since around January this year, we've decided to also start supporting the Walmart marketplace because that has been humming along in the background, but there were a couple of moves that Walmart made in the past couple of months that indicated they were very serious about building their marketplace. One is upgrading their advertising product and opening that up to third-party developers as well. And the other piece is opening their own sort of Amazon-esque fulfillment system. So I think that is a viable marketplace for mass market brands now. And then you've got the category specific marketplaces like Wayfair, if you're in, you know, furniture and different category specific marketplaces that I think that you should look at. But I also, before getting carried away with all these, you know, there's thousands of marketplaces you could be selling on. I think that the best bang for your buck is going to fully optimize the Amazon channel before moving on to those other exciting new channels.
Yeah, very, very interesting. I think it will be, as I said earlier, you know, interesting to watch this trend evolve. And I think the rise of, you know, sort of the acceleration, I shouldn't say rise, the acceleration of the role of e-commerce in the economy, given the COVID situation, potential like long-term adaptation of consumer behavior, you know, the most likely decrease in retail square footage available in the market, and certainly the economics of retail, traditional retail stores is no longer very viable. And so all of this kind of leads to a very interesting dynamic that might actually lead to quite a shift toward these marketplaces having a larger role in e-commerce. And that might be somewhat interim. We'll see. You know, some of these brands that maybe, as we said, currently termed a pseudo brand, for example, digitally native products, as I said earlier, that may have started with a concept to drive all this through a direct engagement with the customer through their websites and apps and so on, looking to these marketplaces as maybe another avenue to grow.
Yeah, I completely agree. E-commerce it's so hard to get right as a channel. You look at a company like Wayfair and their customer acquisition costs are so high, they can't be profitable on the first order. And that is the case for a lot of e-commerce channels. It's a very, very challenging channel with the customer acquisition costs and shipping costs being what they are. And marketplaces are a sort of a soft landing in many ways. Mm-hmm. People are
already there.
Yeah, people are already there. Exactly. They're already shopping. So if you know how to, and I think this is what we're going to talk about next, is if you know how to optimize organic content, you know, from an SEO standpoint, get people to your page, convert them through content. And in, there's so many options these days with optimizing content. You've got the images and rich content, videos, spin images, lots of different ways to do that. And then if your paid search game is strong as well, that's a huge way to drive traffic to your product listings as well.
Well, I mean, a small plug here. I mean, at Bloomreach, for example, we have a pretty interesting SEO capability that's sort of specifically oriented to commerce. And it is kind of interesting even for us to realize now that is more important than ever for our clients, because they need to drive a significant amount of traffic. They need to be discoverable out there, you know, in search, etc., and to have a low cost of customer acquisition. And the most efficient way to do that today is going to be organic search. That's the most efficient way. You know, the cost of customer acquisition, as you talked about, unfortunately, a lot of businesses have a very low repurchase rate. You know, consumers repurchasing within a year is actually very low. And it's an exception for businesses to have a relatively strong repurchase rate, which might be even 2 orders a year. It's remarkable when people really think about it. The cost to then reacquire that customer, right?
Yeah.
Essentially.
You're starting over again.
You're essentially starting over again. And it's just this, unfortunately, the winners in that equation today are the large platforms like Google and Facebook and so forth, where people are paying to reach these eyeballs and attract customers. And there are efficient channels like email and so forth that may have low productivity, but they're relatively low cost, so they continue to be leveraged. But yeah, it's just very interesting. And as e-commerce, as I said earlier, becomes a more important part of the economy, and businesses are looking to essentially, you know, reach consumers in this way, in some cases, maybe really the first time this has really been a priority for them. It'll be interesting to see how all this dynamic unfolds.
Yeah, for sure. Those are great points. And I think that what brands that have a strong e-commerce channel feel that they give up with Amazon, maybe they, you know, customer acquisition costs are better, but they're giving up data and they're giving up priceless data. It's quite difficult to know. I mean, there are third-party software tools that can do this, but what is the repurchase rate on Amazon? You don't get those kind of insights. You really have to dig for, and you don't know who your customers are, what their demographic is, and things like that. There are ways you can get that through the DSP, but things are disjointed, and you don't own it at the end of the day. So there's always for every positive, there is something.
Yeah, you give up a lot of control, right, as a business. Yes. When you're selling through these marketplaces, and Amazon in particular, where, as you said, you don't really have the direct relationship with the customer. You're not really acquiring the customer, I think is even the most important point here. It's a transactional channel.
Exactly.
At the end of the day.
It's very interesting to see. I'm not sure if you've read the Congress inquiry into Amazon's competitive practices last year, but there's a very interesting way of framing it, which is, up until that point, merchants were always trained to think about, this is Amazon's customer, and anytime you did something wrong, it's Amazon's customer, and you're simply supplying Amazon's customer. When the congressional inquiry came through, the language changed, and it was like, you know, Amazon shop is like our merchants' customers and things like that. And it's like, well, they're not really. You don't share any of that information. So I think that there will be, Amazon is going to get bigger. They're going to come through COVID-19 stronger than before, and certainly stronger than their competitors. And there will be more scrutiny of them in this regard.
Yeah, I think I think you're right. I think currently, I think many in the country see Amazon as really a critical utility for the country, which is in some ways Jeff Bezos's dream to be a utility. However, post-crisis, I do think the scrutiny will increase as people really evaluate the business model and question the role of Amazon in the economy, right? And, you know, I don't want to sit here and comment on, you know, all of that necessarily here, but I do think
this
there will be...
Political podcast.
Yeah, it's not a political podcast. I certainly have a point of view as an alumni of Amazon in particular. But nonetheless, I think it will be interesting to see how that plays out in the politics of it all, especially in an election year. Well, Carrie, it's been so great to have you join us. Thank you so much for your time. We do have a standard closing question, and that is, if you sort of, you know, look at innovation, what commerce innovation are you most looking forward to, right? It's something that's sort of out there as a possibility, or maybe it's just emerging and you're like, I think this is dynamite. I think this is going to be really meaningful. Or alternatively, you can also choose to identify something you just feel is just terribly overhyped and you just wish would kind of just go away.
I have to say it is big tech's involvement in the U.S. healthcare system.
Interesting.
It's such a mess. It's experiencing it firsthand over the last few years as well. What a over-bloated, complicated system that has enormous disincentives for efficiency. And I think for the government to come in and take that apart is not totally realistic. But I do see an Apple, an Amazon, maybe multiple players coming in and starting to address aspects of that inefficiency. And you talk about a company, for better or worse, who can make things more efficient. It's Amazon.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they even started their own private sort of healthcare business. Was
so
it JP Morgan Chase?
It'll come in stages. Yeah, it'll come in stages, which will allow, you know, things to unravel at a pace where people are not going to be talking about millions of people out of jobs. But that, I'm personally so jazzed for that disruption to come to pass.
Well, you certainly, you know, have a different perspective than most Americans. Having been, you know, from Australia, you probably have a different view, right, on how things could be or should be, in part because you've experienced a different system. I will say that as a consumer, I can't agree with you more. How frustrating the so-called best healthcare system in the world is. And I do agree that unwinding this from a federal government perspective or even a state government perspective, it can be very challenging. And it's hard to see how that really plays out, especially in our current political environment. I do think the crisis that we're going through now has changed every American's view of the healthcare system dramatically. But I do also agree that the role of big tech here could be very interesting. And certainly seeing what Amazon's doing in their sort of, I don't know exactly the right phrasing for it. It's essentially a private healthcare system that they're developing for their employees currently, right? That's sort of the plan. I think they're partnered with JP Morgan Chase and there's one other.
Yep. And Warren Buffett's company. Yep.
Berkshire Hathaway. Yeah. And the... I think it's in pilot right now in Seattle with Amazon employees, although I haven't talked to anyone yet who's using it to find out what they think. So that's maybe an interesting thing to try to dig into a little bit. But unfortunately, I can't meet up with people at the bar anymore. So
right,
I'm not sure.
Right, yeah.
Just set up some
lifetime.
Zoom calls. Yeah.
Anyway. It's not to say this is not going to be fraught with privacy issues and people are concerned about big tech getting a hold of our health data raises a lot of ethical and privacy issues. So this is just something we'll have to figure out how comfortable we are and how much power we're willing to give a private entity as opposed to, you know, the insurers and it's already...
But at the same time, again, I think the crisis changes our perception of certain things that seemed like untouchable before. Like, you know, now we may be faced with a situation where we have to give health information in order to travel, in order to work, right? We'll see how that plays out, but certainly temperature checks and so-called health passports and things like this may become a reality. So you're already giving up a lot of information. Would you rather give that to a private company, or would you rather have that be in the public realm? You know, again, really interesting question. I'm not sure that we have time to get into now, but Kiri, thank you so much for joining again. Always a pleasure. Be well,
thank you. Be safe.
And for those of you listening, you'll find links to Kiri's information, how to find her and her book and her agency on our landing page. And you can also get in touch with us there. Take care, everyone. Thank you so much for listening.
The State of Commerce Experience podcast is brought to you by Bloomreach, the leader in digital commerce experience. Bloomreach provides solutions for leading businesses all across the world to both drive increased revenue and also to help them personalize the shopping experience for their customers across all of their digital channels. If you'd like to find out more, please visit bloomreach.com.